Time Capsule Podcast. This time, our guest is Professor Sean Springer, PhD. Along with your host, Child of the 80s, and Dr. Retro, we're talking about 80s buddies films. So grab a friend, sit back, and have a listen.
Cinema Time Capsule's mission is to curate and compile the best genre movies of the 80s for future generations to enjoy. We review the movies with help from our esteemed guests to decide collectively if they're as good as we remember them. The movies that are placed in the Cinema Time chosen by you, the viewer. So head to the lobby and get yourself a treat. This episode, we are reviewing 80s buddies movies. I am your host, Child of the 80s, Jeff. Alongside me is my co-host, the doctor of all things retro, Joel.
How's it going, Royal Ugly Dudes?
Heyo. Joel, how are you doing?
I'm well. Thank you for asking. So this week, we have as our special guest, Dr. Sean Springer, who is a professor of film studies at Sheridan College, among other esteemed institutions. Professor Springer covered Andrew Dice Clay, Lenny Bruce, Richard Pryor, and Amy Schumer in his dissertation, and has a deep interest in Marxist and Freudian themes in film. Welcome.
Hey now.
Hey, nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
We're stoked to have you.
So tell us, just for a little color for our listeners, tell us like where, the year you were born, maybe a favorite toy, food, TV show, something like that.
All right. Well, I was born in 77. Summer of Sam.
And very memorable.
Yeah, that was a bad year.
And for some people.
Yeah.
Including our parents.
Yeah. my favorite toy was a miniature Death Star growing up.
Ooh.
So it was like, it was a Death Star, but it was smaller. And
there was, it wasn't a full-size Death Star.
And there was like a trap door for the heroes. Yep. They would go into the machine that would crush
That's
them.
Huge.
Yep.
And there was a bridge for Darth Vader and the Emperor.
Man, how did I not see this?
That was something I would have loved as a kid.
Like, yeah, you could have come over.
If you knew each other.
My favorite food is pizza by a mile. Mm. Any kind of pizza, really. My favorite TV show is The Larry Sanders Show.
Okay.
It's like Gary Shandling. Yep. And
hey now.
I think it's the show that like is responsible more than any other for prestige TV. It's kind of what convinced HBO that you could do The Sopranos, and you could do Curb Your Enthusiasm, you could do everything else. My favorite musician is Frank Zappa.
Right.
And
I remember Professor and I go way back, and I do remember being introduced to your favorite musician and listening over and over and over again to that music.
Yeah, people thought I was a little closed off because I only listened to Frank Zappa.
And Jamiroquai, though. You listened to
I did, yeah.
But just Cosmic
Some
Girl.
Canned Heat? The only.
Yeah, no, see, Canned Heat was after that. Yes. And I thought that album was bad.
Okay.
And everything he's done since then was bad.
Gotcha. Okay.
So Frank Zappa, I'm obsessed with. And my favorite movie is Kiss Me Deadly. It's a 1955 film noir based on a novel by Mickey Spillane.
Right.
Directed by Robert Aldrich. And it's had a lot of influence on films such as Pulp Fiction and Raiders of the Lost Ark and Repo Man. Basically, the ending of Kiss Me Deadly, there's this iconic moment and you see this shot in so many other films. I don't want to give anything away, but...
Well, yeah. It'd be a 70-year spoiler.
So
if you haven't seen it yet, it's their own fault.
The briefcase scene in Pulp Fiction, the Ark scene opening in Raiders.
Okay. Very similar.
The trunk opening in Repo Man, those are from Kiss Me Deadly.
Cool.
I'm going to check it out because I'm into a Golden Age noir horror fix right now, so I'm going to check it out.
Oh, yeah, this movie's amazing.
That's awesome.
Whoa, you're going back pre-80s?
I watched a film last night called Rope from 1948.
Yeah.
That was Hitchcock.
Hitchcock film.
That's great.
Was it good?
Jimmy Stewart.
Yeah. Joel, I'll watch films up to 1999.
Okay.
So everything else is post that, forget it. But anything under, I'll watch. All right. Thank you, Professor. I feel elevated that you're here with us
because
we're
two
not
doctors.
That smart.
We have two doctors. Three doctors, as our producer Simon said, on this podcast. Three doctors.
Well, the doctor of all things retro.
Exactly.
Dr. Springer.
Dr. Marco.
And doctor, we do have a medical doctor on staff as well.
So we cover all of them. A fake doctor, a real doctor of non-medicine, and a doctor of medicine.
Dr. Marco's not a fake doctor.
No, no. I'm a fake doctor.
You're not a fake doctor. You're the doctor of all things retro, and you have a sign hanging up.
I know, but that was just like a dot matrix certificate you printed for me.
Well, I just wanted to hear the noise. Okay, for this episode, we've compiled a list of 80s buddies movies that can be found on Letterboxd at Child of the 80s. As always, we curated a list of 6 movies, with each of us selecting 2 that we would like to see go into the cinema time capsule. So I chose Spies Like Us and Coming to America. Joel, what did you choose?
I chose Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure and Ladies and Gentlemen, The Fabulous Stains.
Professor?
Ishtar and Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
So we asked the professor, because he is your professor of film studies. Is this correct?
I teach film courses at Sheridan.
And we thought that you would pick a theme that would be so academic. And why did you come up with buddy themes? I know I see in the notes.
Well,
give us a little talking point here.
In my dissertation, I had a chapter on Richard Pryor, and as I was reading about him and his film career, he became known for his 80s buddies movies. The first one was 76 Silver Streak with Gene Wilder. Mm-hmm. And they kind of exemplified the interracial buddy movie.
Okay.
Traditionally it'd be, you know, a black character and a white character. They start off on the wrong foot, and eventually they learn to, you know, accept one another and become friends. Hmm. And they were criticized. They have been criticized by a lot of cultural theorists for kind of like simplifying racism.
Right.
It's like, you know, how do you solve racism? Well, you become friends with someone.
It goes away.
You know, you're right. Who, you know, someone who is a member of a different race, and everything will be a-okay. So I always thought buddy movies were fascinating but I've always liked them because they do have this kind of hopeful message.
Sure.
This is the age of Reagan and individuality and an achievement, and usually the buddies are down on their luck, mm-hmm. and they usually don't achieve a whole lot. But in the end, that doesn't really matter because they have each other, they have friendships.
Friends, yeah.
So there is kind of a community spirit to these movies that I do like, mm-hmm. and like, do you guys like the 80s? Like, is this?
Oh, I don't want to leave the 80s.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess when I think of the 80s, I think I'm glad we're not in that decade anymore. And
wait, you like this current time?
Look, if the 80s had gone differently, we wouldn't be in this awful time right now. The 80s are responsible for what's happening right now.
Well, I didn't think that when I was playing with my Darth Vader.
If I had the Death Star, I'd definitely want to be going back and not changing.
There was a lot of escapist entertainment, which is the best part of the 80s. And buddy movies were part of that because you could escape into these little fantasies, mm-hmm. like, you know, where there's this pressure to be the best, to be the big achiever. And then in these buddy movies, it was, you know, I think all of them are kind of like this, where in the end, it doesn't matter if you achieve your goal or not, because you have your friends, you have your community, your family. And that was always a very uplifting message by them. So I've always really liked buddy movies because I thought that they at least kind of gave you a fantasy that let you live outside of the awfulness of the 80s.
I think what I can relate to is like the escapism part. I think that's why I like to go back to retro, because it feels safe and it feels like I'm escaping the real world. And maybe that's what was happening in the 80s. Maybe our parents just wanted to run away.
I think we learned to accept everything because we had these fantasy worlds to live in. You know, so while your unions are being destroyed and jobs are being sent overseas, you know, you can pretend you're Luke Skywalker. Everything's fun.
And I imagine too, us being kids at that age, we weren't thinking about those very issues because we didn't know about them. So us returning to that then brings us back to what was fun about being 7 and 8.
Yeah,
and then running around and having friends. It was simple and it was escapist compared to now when we're adults and we should probably think about it a lot more.
But we still need it.
Absolutely.
So I'm glad you guys are doing this.
Well, thank you very much, Professor. So we appreciate you kind of outlining buddy films mean to you. Just for our reference, we didn't take into account the buddy cop films.
Nope.
we kind of, yeah, because that would have sent us into another category. So yeah, don't worry, folks. We will cover that eventually. Some notable 80s buddies films include Blues Brothers, Twins, Weekend at Bernie's, the prior Wilder films, Beaches, Outrageous Fortune, Midnight Run, Big Business, Trading Places, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, Throw Mama from the Train, Rain Man, Night Shift, and many, many, many more. So on that note, we're going to take a quick break and come back with our first film discussion.
Boom.
Hey now.
Spies like us. Chevy Chase and Dan Aykroyd.
We've got a very special assignment for you two.
Boy.
Heads down!
This is my sister. You can all have her.
You want a coffee? That's a good idea.
See that?
Hey, come on.
Honestly, you two are unbelievable.
Stop it!
Every minute you don't tell us why you're here, I cut off a finger.
Mine or yours?
Yours.
Damn.
Down!
Hi-yo, Silver! Away!
Chevy Chase.
Get us the hell out of here!
Dan Aykroyd.
To think my high school guidance counselor said I'd never amount to anything.
Spies like us.
We're Americans!
Welcome back, everyone. We're excited to jump into the six films that we chose for you to watch with us. And we are going to start first with Jeff's selection, 1985's Spies Like Us.
Okay, this film starred little-known actor Chevy Chase.
Who?
Dan Aykroyd. Dan Aykroyd's wife, Donna Dixon, and many, many cameos. Mm. This was written by both Dan Aykroyd and SCTV alumnus Dave Thomas.
Hamiltonian.
I had no idea that Thomas co-wrote this film. Mm. Did you guys?
Nope. I had no idea.
One of the more interesting directors of the time, John Landis, directed this film, and he's had some problematic things over the course of his career that the professor will jump in on for sure. We've already spoken about it. Spies Like Us is a Cold War era espionage spoof released in 1985, directed by John Landis. The film follows two hapless government employees, Emmett Fitzhugh and Austin Milbarge, who are selected by the CIA as decoys for a secret mission to infiltrate the Soviet Union, which is no more. Fitzhugh and Milbarge, who have no actual spy training, are sent on a series of misadventures, including a brutal training exercise, a mission to deliver medical supplies in Afghanistan, and ultimately the mission to the Soviet Union. Two bumbling agents stumble their way through their mission, mistakenly believing they are succeeding, while the real CIA agents monitor their progress from afar. They eventually discover they are pawns in a larger plot to distract the Soviet Union from a more important mission along the way. They also encounter a beautiful Russian agent who helps... Oh, sorry, that's not a beautiful Russian agent.
It isn't?
It's not?
No, she's a CIA agent who helps them complete their mission, and that's played by Donna Dixon.
Interesting. And what did the critics have to say about this film that you chose?
So here's the...
Washington Post, I believe, had very strong feelings.
Well, go ahead, read it.
Okay.
Because I know you want to do this.
This could have been me writing for the Washington Post if I wasn't 8 years old at the time. It's the kind of stuff you come up with when you're not trying very hard. And on Spies Like Us, no one seems to be trying. And that can be very trying indeed. They were not fans.
The Washington Post. Just to let you know, though, as I go back and look at these critical responses, basically no critics like movies.
That's true.
At all.
Well, or at least you can always find there will always be someone saying, oh, this movie's no good.
Siskel and Ebert hated every movie.
There are a lot of Debbie Downers on the movies.
Yes. Yes. So I'm not fazed by this. No. That means when I was a kid, if I would see it, you know, Siskel or Ebert, I'd just be like, okay, that's the movie I want to see because they hated it.
Yeah, my wife's family does that. They will say, oh, well, these people hated Ace Ventura and Dumb and Dumber, so clearly it must be a great movie.
It's got to be good. Okay, Joel, go for it.
So, child of the 80s, why did you choose this movie?
Okay, so as a kid, I was a huge like SNL fan. Dan Aykroyd, Chevy Chase. My father was big into SNL and SCTV. So any movie that would come out in this genre, we would watch it.
Yep.
Even if it was totally inappropriate.
Well, that was what your family watched all the time.
Yeah, yeah. So it's just in our wheelhouse. So I think this is a great example of Cold War and espionage, the fervor that was threaded through the 80s, mm-hmm. especially for kids that have no idea.
Right.
John Landis does an excellent job satirizing the hysteria of the time. And like, looking back, it's kind of funny that these were real issues that people were deeply frightened of. So some films such as like Red Dawn took it really seriously, which is another amazing film. And Spies Like Us kind of turned it into a farce to mm-hmm. inject a little bit of levity there.
Right. So why do you think this movie should go in the Cinema Time Capsule?
Okay, so I'm not saying it's the greatest example of a buddy film, but it's a great example of tensions that were mm-hmm. embedded in North American culture in the 80s. It's totally hyperbolic. I think it would fit into our Cinema Time Capsule as a piece of Cold War history, maybe mm-hmm. not necessarily a buddy film, but the two players that go back and forth I think they do the job well. It's probably not going to resonate with my kids. I didn't watch it with them. Usually I'll play it back and forth and, you know, have a conversation with them. I didn't watch this with them because I knew that they're not interested in war and espionage mm-hmm. and stuff like that.
Right.
Whereas I was a kid, like it was all G.I. Joe and Rambo and I would just suck it up. So yeah, it could go.
When it comes to the satire, I was surprised. I didn't remember them it being a satire, but there's the scene where they parachute, I think, into Afghanistan and they like destroy someone's house and then the crate opens and they're drinking Budweiser and it's like this is the American impact, you know. It's these drunken fools just destroying other people's lands and having no idea what they're doing. You know, but then there are more powerful people above them who actually do know what they're doing and are sending them in.
Right.
You know, so then that's there too.
Yeah. That scene that you talk about when the crate opens up and they're just like laying there, like there's like cases of beer.
Yeah.
Just falling all over the place. I was just like, this is awesome. Like the government gives them alcohol.
Yeah, I mean, I think when I saw it as a kid, I didn't think to myself, oh, Americans shouldn't be doing this. I just thought that would be fun.
Ha, ha, ha. Yeah. I thought the same thing as a kid. I thought this would be awesome. Let's get our training. I love, you know, that Joe Schmoes could be...
Right.
If you're a Joe Schmo in North America, you could be trained as a secret agent. And I wanted to be a secret agent. Mm.
And it looked fun. Like I remember the trailer had the, you know, heads down and they get into the mud and they start firing the machine guns on them. Trailer. And that made me want to see the movie.
Did you, either of you want to be like a spy?
Oh yeah,
of course.
Okay. So as a kid, I don't know how they market films to kids, but I think for some reason they figured out kids might like this movie as well, but it was not. The content was not kid-friendly.
No,
but
not at all. It was inappropriate.
It was totally not kid-friendly, but this was a favorite film of mine.
Do you have a favorite? What's your favorite quote from the movie?
So I didn't realize this at the time, but these are, Professor, you might know maybe a bit more about this. I don't want to put you on the spot, but these were like an ode to road trip films.
Yeah, there were these Bob Hope and Bing Crosby movies that these films were an homage to.
Really?
And so Ishtar is an homage to these films as well, where these two buddies go on the road and get up to all sorts of hijinks.
So I like that set up. So one of my favorite quotes would have been that whole doctor scene.
Yes.
Doctor. And it's very lazy. So, like, I get the critics, like, talking about the writing where all the doctors line up and just introduce, hello, doctor, 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 doctor. So they all do the intro, and then the outro, they do the same thing. It's totally inane and stupid, but I laugh every time.
Yeah. I wondered, Professor, is that how all staff meetings work for you at work?
You know, I'm because I'm a contract professor, I don't go to staff meetings.
Ah, you get to avoid them.
I get to avoid them.
Do you feel like you're missing that then? Because this would be happening and you'd like it?
Well, I feel very dispensable, so I feel a lot like the spies in this movie. Like, I think the department, if I were to be assassinated, I would not be missed. So,
yeah. So you're the plant, basically.
I'm the plant, yeah. They send me into the classroom expecting the kids to off me. Can I read my favorite quote about spies?
Yes.
So this is from a movie called The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, and played by and the spy who came in from the cold is named Alec Lemus, played by Richard Burton. And at the end of the movie, he gives a speech about what spies are, and it's one of my favorite quotes of all time. He says, what the hell do you think spies are? Moral philosophers measuring everything they do against the word of God or Karl Marx? They're not. They're just a bunch of seedy, squalid bastards like me. Little men, drunkards, queers, henpecked husbands, civil servants playing cowboys and Indians to brighten their rotten little lives. Do you think they sit like monks in a cell, balancing right against wrong? Yesterday would have killed Munt because I thought him evil and an enemy, but not today. Today he is evil and my friend. London needs him. They need him so that the great moronic masses you admire so much can sleep soundly in their flea-bitten beds again. They need him for the safety of ordinary, crummy people like you and me. So,
that is doctor.
You can cut that, but
you can cut that.
I just wanted to say that out loud.
Have you seen that film?
The Spy Who Came In From the Cold?
Yes.
Yes.
Is it, do you think that Landis borrowed from that? Or is it totally
maybe.
Different?
Maybe. It's very different. This is a Cold War film. It's like set in the 60s, so it's totally different. I don't think he borrowed from it. It's totally irrelevant, really, to what we're talking about.
Perfect.
Yeah. I mean, that's why you're here, to add color where necessary.
Yeah.
And thank you for bringing that. I appreciate it.
So what did you take away, or when you revisited this, Jeff, what did you find that
when
you
say
landed and loved?
When you say revisited, what do you mean?
I mean, just you watched recently, although you, I think you said, was it this one that you said you watched probably once or twice a year?
It's probably more like three or four times a year.
Really?
I rewatch movies incessantly.
And this is one of them?
Yes. Why did you say it like that?
I said I was going to rewatch this film, and I tried to, and I really it was challenging.
What was so challenging about it?
You know, I mean, Chevy Chase is really of his time. Like, yeah, I don't think anyone.
That's what I thought too.
I don't think anyone, you know, after 1990 thought he was funny anymore. He did a few movies after then, and they were awful.
Can you, Joel? Mm-hmm. What did you say about? This is an interesting thing that I think a few people have talked about with Chevy Chase.
Oh,
his appeal.
Yeah, that in the movie, he's basically irresistible to women, which, you know, we talked about on the last episode how women just basically are, they're part of the plot, a conqueror, someone or something, unfortunately, to be conquered by the man. And in this movie, it's like he just tells women what to do and they're all over him. And like, I don't know, maybe that was true back then, that people that were women thinking he was really attractive and desirable, because he doesn't appear that way to me.
He was considered like for comedians to be like one of the sexier comedians,
right?
You know, and that's kind of awkward to think nowadays. Nowadays every comedian goes into the gym.
Yeah, they take the steroids and they get the hair transplants.
That's
and,
right. They don't. Yeah. They didn't and do it bronze. As much back then.
And I guess maybe if you're super funny, then that's attractive. And I hope that's part. That's actually
see, I
true.
I see it
whereas,
as.
I don't.
I see it as a gag. Yeah. I think that I almost like people are writing for him, like on the nose. Like, oh, maybe he thinks he's like this. So let's write him as a stud muffin, because they do it for Bill Murray too. Like, they write a lot like that for Bill Murray.
If you were thin and you had decent bone structure, you would be the handsome leading man. Seriously.
It's true.
But if you were fat, you wouldn't be. I mean, that's not a nice thing to say, but it's true. That's how you know, our body phobic culture is. You know?
Right. So they, basically, in the 80s, everyone had bad teeth and their hair was falling out. So if you remotely fit some appealing category, you became the hunk.
Yeah.
Got it. So maybe, I don't think Chevy Chase was the be-all, end-all for sure.
But you found this, you still find him to be very, very funny in this movie, him and Aykroyd.
I enjoy all the SNL alumnus, for sure, and all the SCTV alumnus, just for what they bring. So I guess the overall, I think looking at it as a kid, I love the acts, the way it's set up. Mm-hmm. I love the, here's the bumbling fools,
right.
Here's the training scene, here's the fish out of water, they save the world, and it's just appealing to me because it is a very 80s film.
Mm-hmm.
And they save the world because Danny Aykroyd goes, wait a second, if you go boop, 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 then everything will fit together. I think that's it, right?
It's essentially it.
Okay.
I can't believe they gave away the secrets.
His pseudo-intellectualism in every movie that Dan Aykroyd does is brilliant, too.
Yeah.
It's like they all have their like characters that they play in every single movie, and I like that.
There is. It is nice to think that the Cold War could be solved just by like letting the like drunken idiots meet in a room together and like have sex and you know and like just get wasted and that and boop, that
boop.
Yeah
boop boop
go boop, boop boop.
So one of my favorite scenes though, you brought up the it's very how do I say this?
I don't know.
Without being gross out, it's a very hot film at the end. Everyone gets all charged up because the world's going to end.
Right.
And one of my favorite scenes is the pairing off scene.
That's a good scene.
And I think it's just done well. Like everyone starts to look at each other and then the two dudes look at each other and wink and then they go away. And then the older woman and the older man look at each other and then everyone's just pairing off because that's basically the way the world would end.
I mean, I don't think that's what I would do. I would run
what
in.
What would you do?
If the
world was going to end.
Man, I'd probably find a way to kill myself in a really painless way. I would probably take a lot of heroin. No, I instead of like, you know, like a nuke, like peeling my skin off, you know, I'd rather go out in somewhat, you know, peacefully.
Mm.
Well, that's just me.
I mean, and that's why we brought the professor on for that levity and for that honesty. And then I just want to finish off. We're talking about this movie way too long, but I was always drawn to their Arctic outfits. I always wanted them. And I was always angry because I was more of an Aykroyd fan that he got the crappier outfit. Because he looks like a sheep, whereas Chevy Chase always got the girl. And then he's got the best outfit. He's got this fur cap on.
Well, that's probably why the ladies liked him so much.
So I would get frustrated by that.
Aykroyd does get a girl in the end, though.
He does. Yeah. He does. And the one thing I don't understand is, are they actually speaking Russian in this film? And I think I don't know. That's a good question. I know Dr. Marco is a Slavic language specialist as well, so maybe I'll ask him.
What G.I. Joe character did those remind you of? I wonder if there's
just
a connection there.
Them.
No, but wasn't there specific... one that had like some snow job.
Okay. I have snow job still.
Yeah. I figured there was a connection.
Yeah. And Blizzard. So anyway, that's enough about,
Spies Like Us.
Sounds like you both hated it. And, I don't care. I'm going to watch it 3 or 4 more times, maybe this week. That's your problem.
It was, I'll say of all of these movies, this was my least enjoyed one.
Oh, great. I can't wait to talk about yours.
Yeah, I know.
Let's roll that beautiful bean footage.
It will come around to me.
Next. Okay. Thank you for your input. So you guys, you're saying this does not go in the Cinema Time Capsule.
Does it go in for like movie enjoyment?
Just are you putting it in the Cinema
Time Capsule? Yeah, I would. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
You said you hated it.
I said it. It's not. It's not a movie that in 2023 I can sit down and like get into, you know. But it's a movie that I think is important for all the reasons you said.
Why? Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah. Joel, what do you say?
I would not.
Okay.
I think as
I'll concur.
For Professor, a lot of these films I did not see. I grew up in a fairly conservative home. And so a lot of the times the movies that we're talking about that Jeff has watched 3 times a year since he was 6, I've never watched. They just didn't come back around. They weren't such touchstones that then I engaged with, you know, as a teenager. Sort of like, you know, when you turn 14 or 15, for sure you're watching Strange Brew and you're watching Monty Python Holy Grail. This Spies Like Us wouldn't be in that realm. So then I'm only watching it for the first time as an adult, and then thinking, okay, you know, Chevy Chase in Christmas Vacation, perfect. This, I just don't find it that funny. And I think, yeah, the time period has passed such that I can't go back to why this was good then. I'm watching it now as an adult going, I don't like this now. But if I had seen it then maybe I would love it now still. But
there's a thing that's in almost all the movies about basically this is a decade where exploitation films are kind of over because all the, you know, nudity and sexual gratification of those movies are now in these popular movies. Mm. And so a big pull of these movies is, oh, so Chevy Chase, what's his main goal? It's just to see women without their clothes and to touch them in inappropriate ways. Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Let's watch that. Whereas, you know, nowadays it's like, you know,
that's wrong.
Our movies don't do that anymore, you know, and we've kind of, you know, it's an awkward conversation because, you know, that's more of, you know, what happens in certain online forums now. Whereas back then it was in those Hollywood movies that were just singularly focused on having sex and on the men ogling women.
Hmm. Yeah, fornication is a big theme in 80s films.
Yeah,
and like inappropriate nudity, like placement.
Yeah,
which is why probably so many people went to them because
like you couldn't, you know, in the 60s that was just like exploitation films. Like you had to be a lot more conservative. Right. Like the guy who wanted the girl couldn't be like, well, what I really want is this. Ho ho ho. He had to actually pretend he wanted to get married.
Right.
You know. But this is like, we don't get married.
Yeah.
It doesn't have anything to do with the plot. Let's throw it in. Okay. Well, moving on. Thank you. Joel's selection is Ladies and Gentlemen, The Fabulous Stains.
Yes.
You're fired.
I need the money.
Corinne Burns, what are you going to do?
My name is not Corinne Burns.
Oh, what is it?
It's third degree burn. I'm the lead singer and manager for the Stains.
Suckers! Suckers!
And it has become clear to several thousand very young women, inspired by an unrecorded rock and roll band with see-through blouses and white stripes in their hair, that life is to be lived right now.
You are gonna be really good. Can't explain it.
Fast.
What it really amounts to is girl dropouts who are using the media.
She said things that I've always wanted to say, and I haven't been able to.
We're the Stains, and we don't put out.
We weren't like that, were we, Brenda?
No, we weren't.
You are moving so fast. You're happening so fast. You can't afford to be loyal to this guy.
Why are you still hanging around here? Why don't you just go back to wherever it was you came from?
You've got a lot to learn, you little... Yeah, I want to see the world for free.
Rhino Entertainment presents a Lou Adler film, Ladies and Gentlemen, The Fabulous Stains. DVD and soundtrack now available.
So to be clear, maybe I give a little bit of an introduction of why I chose this. So I really struggled when this theme was brought up in terms of buddy movies, because Bill and Ted jumped to mind immediately, which we'll get to. And then Bob and Doug, my other favorite duo. But then I couldn't really think of anything else other than cop ones. And we knew that we were going to save those. So then I just went online and started searching under this. And then as I came across options, then this one jumped up. And I thought, oh, that sounds interesting. And it was written by a woman, the lead character's female. I thought, oh, okay, this will be a good balance because, as we were talking about before, these are heavily male-centered duos in movies. So this was that's how I landed on this one.
They're essentially all Laddish films. Like, they're all male juxtapositions, right? Like, it's just, is that because you guys think it's the writers that are just writing from what they know, or?
I think there is a feminist backlash in these films where it's, you know, where men are getting to reassert themselves. And it's like, well, okay, maybe we don't rule the roost anymore, but we can still go, leave the home and kind of have fun with each other. And in that way, we will kind of, you know, reassert our dominance. I think that's happening in these movies. I mean, and the movies are, you know, even though this was written by a woman, like they're all being greenlit by men mainly.
Yes, true. You know,
so
yeah. So the Ladies and Gentlemen, The Fabulous Stains is from 1982. It is starring Diane Lane as Corinne Burns, Maren Cantor as her sister Tracy, and Laura Dern is their cousin, if I recall correctly. Ray Winstone, who you know from The Departed, and then a bunch of actual musicians from punk bands, including Steve Jones and Paul Cook from the Sex Pistols, Paul Simonon from The Clash, Vince Welnick and Fee Waybill from the Tubes. And the writer is Nancy Dowd, though she used the pseudonym Rob Morton, interestingly, to that point. And she wrote Slapshot.
Did not know that.
Canadian classic. It was directed by Lou Adler, who directed and produced Up in Smoke, as well as produced the Monterey Pop movie and Rocky Horror Picture Show. So big into music. So our movie follows Corinne Burns, and she is a typical frustrated teenager living in a nowhere town until she catches a punk band called The Looters. After the death of her mother and intrigued by the punk scene, she and her fledgling band, The Stains, join the tour of a washed-up glam metal band and a rising punk English punk band, and in no time at all become media magnates. The band forms a rabid following of young girls while Corinne begins a relationship with Looters singer Billy, and as The Stains get bigger and bigger, however, her ambition gets the better of her.
Okay. Well, thank you for that synopsis. Where do you, what are your highs for this film? What do you think elevates this film into the cinema time capsule?
Right. I like I said, I wasn't sure what to expect when I picked it. I was hopeful, but you know, when you haven't really heard of a movie and it's 40 years old, my expectations are pretty low. But in high school, I got into punk rock, so then I was intrigued by the scene and going back to the earlier days of that. And I was pleasantly surprised that I really liked this movie more than I was expecting to. It was very gritty, working class town. It was pretty spot on from what I've known over the years in the music scene of people, musicians trying to make it. How do they get breaks or nod, and they just, you know, are maybe playing around town for the rest of their life. I thought the presentation of it from a female perspective was interesting and engaging, and gave an alternate view of the music scene. The movie, as I learned afterwards, is a cult favorite. Like, it's quite well known and has a long life. With many famous folks that are digging it. So I really liked it. It obviously had a bunch of real musicians, so that probably added to its genuineness, that these guys from punk bands probably were like, that would never happen. This is what would happen. So I enjoyed that. And I thought the characters were believable and the performances were really good. So I really liked it.
Professor, I really liked it too. It was my first time seeing it. I thought it was great.
Cool.
Yeah. We'll get into lows, I guess, in a bit. But yeah, I didn't like the ending, but everything else.
The ending was really bad. And what I learned, I don't know if you read about it at all, but the So the director and the writer were at odds with each other on how to end the film, and it actually sat post-production for 2 years unfinished because they couldn't agree. And then the director eventually just cut that music video and put it in opposition to what the writer wanted. And so that, yeah, it feels the ending of the actual scene and then that don't match.
But, you know, I was okay. So I was actually okay with the music video. I didn't like the fact that the movie's saying, you know, hey, you know, young women, we need our own space. You know, we don't need to please the boys.
Yep.
And then, and what did they do in the end? Well, they listened to a man. You know, so it's right. Like, so the guy comes out and he says, hey, all you young women, you're being brainwashed. Okay. And they go, you know what? You're right. And it's like, wait a second. No, the message is you don't have to listen to him.
Oh, okay.
And also, you know, people weren't total morons back then. Like, people knew that, you know, sure, there was consumerism happening and that's how people made money. And they didn't have to buy all that junk. And, you know, if their idol said they should buy it, you know, you didn't have to listen to her. So for them to kind of storm the stage and be like, outrageous, how dare you? That rang really false to me.
Yep.
I would have liked if they just kind of kept going and going and going. So I guess I was okay with the music video because I was like, yeah, that's where they should end up.
Right.
You know, that was my only beef with the movie.
Right. Yeah. Jeff, you did not enjoy this one.
Okay. Hold on a second. Okay. Rewind. Okay. Hold on. I've said it many times. There's not an 80s film that I do not enjoy. Okay.
I don't know.
I've said that.
I go back to your texts.
But I did only put one note in this, and it says, is this a joke? I've literally been punked. Because it's not the film. I just don't think it fits in this category at all.
Hmm. It's not a
Tell me the buddy duo. I can't even, it was there's no buddy.
There was two that I thought of. One, it's either the Staines themselves, and especially the sisters, but there's the three of, it's more three, you're right. Or in some way, it's Billy and Corinne.
Yeah.
Like the two leaders of the two bands, and then how their relationship plays out as they grow and then fall apart. But that's...
I don't want to dominate the conversation and bring it down to like a low point, but I just didn't have any fun while I was watching it. It wasn't like I was like, this is a fun, this is a romp. And I think that's what I was feeling for buddy films.
True.
And I guarantee that Spies Like Us got more votes than this. I guarantee
I think very few people have seen this. And you're right, it is totally different. That it's not comedic. There's some moments, but it's not a comedy. And it's more, I think, challenging. It is looking at the world through, to some degree, through a feminist lens of what are these girls' experience in this music scene. And it wasn't good. To some degree. Yeah.
We'd said that it was, you know, we overtaxed that, you know, it was kind of 10 years ahead of its time, that, you know, with the influence on the riot girl scene.
Right. Yep.
And, you know, the band reminded me of Bikini Kill a fair bit. The big difference being, though, that, you know, in this movie, there's no kind of feminist network. There's no kind of DIY network where people are making zines and, you know, you're learning about each other, you know, through your own media. They rely on the local media. Which is, you know, which has the one guy who's this kind of sexist pig.
Yeah.
Who is, you know, filtering the band and influencing the message. So you kind of see why, you know, they decided that this band couldn't break in the early 80s. By the early 90s, it could break.
And in that way, the movie was the precursor.
Yeah.
So you're right that it was commented that it led or contributed to or influenced the Riot Girl scene with K Records and all the bands from there. And even the name The White Stripes, like that's what the fans were known as. And I don't know, like that seems like two dots and drawing the line between them. So in that way, you're right. Maybe that development is what wasn't there in the movie, and then women were like, "Oh, well, we're gonna make this.
We can do it, but we have to do it ourselves. Yeah, we can't rely on the local news to promote us."
Yeah, and he, I mean, it was fun to see him get his butt handed to him at points when he's trying to be sarcastic and dismissive, and then the female anchor puts him in his place.
I thought it was a lot of fun too, seeing the two male dominant bands, you know, behind the scenes, and that they're fighting, and you get the sense that the new punk band is basically on the same career arc as the old rock band, you know, and eventually having the Sex Pistols drummer there kind of brings that home, you know.
Yeah.
You know, what member of that band will end up like Sid Vicious, you know? So I thought that was a lot of fun. In fact, at first, when they first go on tour, I'm like, this isn't even about the Staines. It seemed to be more about these dudes fighting than anything else.
So then, the things that were, it was a bit uncomfortable. Like, I did think the performances were great, especially seeing Diane Lane and Laura Dern early. But I was also uncomfortable because they're playing teenagers and they're like see-through shirts and stuff. It feels weird to me watching this.
It is weird. It's a weird film, man.
Teens, but half naked.
I like that they came out and they were like, you know, we don't put out. And it was very, it was very rat girlish where it's like, we're going to dress this way, but, you know, we're going to control the message.
Yeah.
You know?
And that's, and like some of the quotes that were really good, they're not family friendly, but they were definitely in that same lane of where they didn't take junk from the guys. She just gave it back to them and like wouldn't be silenced or put in her place, that she fought right back.
And the aunt, played by Christine Lodi, I thought she gave like an amazing monologue halfway through the film. I thought it was really moving, where she, you know, the reporter asked her to talk about, you know, her daughter. And at first she's kind of criticizing her daughter. And then she basically apologizes for being a bad mom and says how happy she is that her daughters are out there having fun and how she wishes her parents had supported her and that she feels bad she didn't support her daughter. Her daughter's rising above all that anyway.
Yep.
And I was like, oh, this is really nice, touching moral.
I would have been on there saying, please just come home now. Like, as a parent, I'd be like, no, let's come home and we'll get you on the track for proper education. Because the band sucked. They weren't very good.
No, they weren't, but they were developing. Nope. And
Then they just got all glam at the end, man. They sold out.
But what were their options, right? Because this is a working class town. Corinne at the beginning of the movie is like, you know, she's working at a fast food joint. She quits it, you know, and then it's, well, like, what are her options? This is a great moment in, not a great moment, but this is a moment in history where white teenagers can begin to expect to earn less than their parents on average.
Right.
So it's, this is the era of where downward mobility starts, and we're still in it, you know? Like, my kids, you know, welcome to the world, kids. You're going to do worse than I did. And I'm doing worse than my parents.
This is the speech that Professor Springer is going to give in the movie.
That's right.
That we're making.
I'm like, the world stinks. And, our parents screwed up. We're screwing up. You kids try to make it a little
go
bit
make
better.
A crappy band work.
Well, it's saying that this is your only hope because we haven't given you the tools to do anything else. You might as well go play the lottery, see if you can have a band. If not, you'll have a terrible life anyway.
Deep thoughts.
And
by
I think
Professor Springer.
Your point that they were doing this for themselves because they wanted to. They didn't, as they show in the film, they didn't know how to play instruments. They just went and did it because they caught a vision for it and were excited by it. Sort of like a couple old 40-ish guys doing a podcast about movies from the 80s.
This is punk.
Yeah. Super punk.
Okay, so you said something. Okay, I don't mean to like drag you through the mud, but this is a very cosmic Christmas thing with you and I. You go and give me something that you probably know. You probably did this to anger me. There you go in your notes. You're like,
angry child is a funny
no
child.
Films the buddy. There's no buddy films that I know. Okay, here's the list of buddy films. Just to recap it: Blues Brothers, never heard of that. Twins, never heard of that. Weekend at Bernie's, never heard of that. You never heard of any of these?
No, I've heard of most of them, they didn't come to mind.
What do you mean?
I'm just telling you. When we came up, it was actually way later.
Please call in.
Then I thought of Rain Man. Way later.
Okay, but come on. You've never heard of Weekend at Bernie's?
Yeah, but again, a movie I didn't see. I haven't seen.
What?
Yeah.
Okay. Then you never saw Twins?
I did see Twins, but
you thought The Stains was better than Twins.
I thought it had potential,
Simon,
compared to.
Have you seen, tell us what you think of The Fabulous Stains and listen to this. I don't know his response. I know what he's going to say. Go ahead.
I didn't see the.
I've never seen this. I knew he would say that.
But you know, I think that's my role as producer. Jeepers. I try to remain impartial and watch all of these.
Simon, you got to see. You'll love it. It's not I actually, love it. It's
I really good. Do want to see it now, actually.
Oh,
it
Professor Springer's just saying that because he wants to sound avant-garde. But let's be honest. No one saw this movie.
It only made $25,000 in its office.
It's not even the best music film of the 80s. So.
No, it might not be, but
it's not.
But I
support it.
Is anyone saying it's the best music film of the 80s?
It's certainly not the best buddy movies of the 80s. It's not even a buddy film.
Okay, I wouldn't call it a buddy movie, but, you know.
Rant over. But Mike, I'm dropping the mic.
I think the fact that there are so few women buddy movies is interesting.
Outrageous Fortune.
Did you watch that when you were a kid?
Outrageous Fortune, I love Beaches.
Outrageous Fortune is awful.
The Wind Beneath My Wings, man.
As a child, you're telling me you watched Beaches.
Can you find Joel's birth certificate? He's clearly not born in the 80s. Who has not seen Beaches? Simon?
I asked you,
Simon,
as
have
a
you
child,
seen Beaches?
Did you watch Beaches in the 80s?
You are the wind beneath my wings.
You didn't answer my question. Did you watch Beaches while you were in the
80s? Oh, my gosh. My sister and I had that on
okay,
VHS.
I didn't.
Have you seen Beaches, producer Simon?
I have never seen Beaches.
Hey!
You are the wind.
That's all I know.
Way better than the Stain song.
Stop singing. It's we're going to have to pay for that.
It's very different.
Yeah, different genre.
All right, I'm done. So obviously the Stain is going to win.
Nope.
So
it's okay if it doesn't.
I apologize, Joel.
No,
I just get
all right.
I'm very guarded with the 80s films. Thank you, Joel. Thank you, Professor Springer. I'm really heated right now, so we need to go to a commercial break. I'm going to go break something.
Not the pottery.
3, 2, 3, 4. 4, 2, 3, and.
These men are pawns.
I put a price of 20,000 dirham on their heads.
Next, they will be hailed as the true messenger of God.
They were just a couple of songwriters who came to Ishtar to break into show business.
Easy boy.
What the hell's the matter with him? Is he blind?
Well, yeah, he is, but he's in perfect condition.
So how do they wind up on everyone's hit list?
Your life is in danger.
Behave normally. We have guns pointed at your back. No, don't put your hands up, you idiot.
My little darling. My little darling.
I can't believe these men may control the fate of the Middle East.
How are you?
Do it. Ay, 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 schmeckle, butter, hot for ya!
This is unbelievable.
Hoopa, hoopa, hoopa.
No, it will not.
That's my lover.
Oh, are the two American messengers of God dead yet?
Is this the oasis?
Does this look like an oasis to you?
Yeah, look at the birds. Are those vultures?
Yeah.
How are you?
He's aiming at him.
Will you stop me? Paranoid!
Run, Smuck! They're trying to kill us!
Warren Beatty, Dustin Hoffman, Isabella Gianni.
Your girl! How did she get to be your girl?
Only you!
I think they're wonderful.
Ishtar. Written and directed by Elaine May.
This is some of our best work.
The next film on our illustrious list is 1989's Ishtar, which was selected by the professor. So tell us about it.
All right. Ishtar stars Warren Beatty, Dustin Hoffman, Isabella Gianni, and Charles Grodin. Written and directed by Elaine May and produced by Warren Beatty. It is about Chuck and Lyle. They are two untalented singer-songwriter duettists. They aspire to be like Simon and Garfunkel. They get their big break playing a club in Morocco, in Marrakech, Morocco, but on their way, they do a stopover in Ishtar, which is a fictitious North African country that is led by a corrupt government propped up by the CIA. So when when they land there, Chuck lends a beautiful woman his passport, and then the pair find themselves wanted dead by both the CIA and leftist rebels. And eventually, in an ending reminiscent of Spies Like Us, they solve a political crisis and launch their careers.
Roger Ebert, what did he say?
Roger Ebert, he's someone who's never kind of understood like self-parody, who doesn't really get when people are intentionally doing something poorly. Have you guys seen Tim and Eric's billion-dollar movie?
No.
Tim Heidecker.
I think I've heard of it.
Eric Warheim. That movie is like, it's intentionally bad, intentionally stupid, and it's one of his, Roger Ebert's, what was one of his like most hated movies of all time. and Ishtar, he hated Ishtar as well, because he didn't, you know, because Ishtar is about two guys trying to do a bad job on purpose. Like, the actors are trying to be terrible. Yeah. And
they succeeded.
And he doesn't get that. So he wrote, there's no hint of Hoffman's wit and intelligence in Tootsie, no suggestion of Beatty's grace and good humor in Heaven Can Wait, no chemistry between two actors who should be enjoying the opportunity to act together, no life.
He also said, it's a truly dreadful film, a lifeless, massive, lumbering, exercise and failed comedy.
Yeah, I didn't want to put that part in, but yes, he does say that too.
And I think he, correct me if I'm wrong, he was not alone in the disdain for this film back when it came out.
No, I bet, you know, it's 40% on Rotten Tomatoes, which is not like, you know,
sure,
which is not what's the Adam Sandler movie where he plays the brother and sister?
I don't know that one.
Jack and Jill.
Yeah, this isn't Jack and Jill territory. But yeah, he gave it half a star. Siskel hated it. A lot of people hated it, but it gained this reputation of being a terrible film before it was even released or even viewed by critics.
Okay, fair.
Because the filming was a fiasco.
Yes.
And basically, all the people talked about was how much it cost.
Mm.
People were like, oh, it's $40 million they spent, or $51 million. At that time, it was the most spent on a comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Don't quote me on that, but it was...
You just quoted yourself. You did.
Okay,
you
well...
We recorded
so
it.
So I hear. And... so it, and also people were very happy to see Warren Beatty fail. He's a very overconfident, narcissistic man.
Okay.
And so they were kind of waiting for him to have a stinker. And so I think all the knives came out when it was rumored that Warren Beatty might have a stinker.
Mm.
And so Ishtar became it.
Gotcha. So why did you choose a stinker?
Because I chose the stinker because I love Elaine May. I think she is she was part of this kind of 60s new wave of comedy movement with Mike Nichols and May. They did these really kind of funny, dryly humorous comedy sketches, and then she went on to have her own career as a writer and a director. One of my favorite movies of all time is Mikey and Nikki, directed by her, starring Peter Falk and John Cassavetes. After that came out in 76, that was such a fiasco in filming that she didn't direct again until 87.
Hmm.
And she'd done a lot of work as a script doctor. So she script doctored Heaven Can Wait and Reds for Beatty. She had script doctored Tootsie for Dustin Hoffman. And Warren Beatty wanted to give her, basically, he wanted to kind of champion her, you know, because, I mean, her vision was widely recognized. So they decided to do Ishtar together, and they had a major falling out in the filming of Ishtar. And so it became this very expensive fiasco. Everyone knew that the film was not put together in a totally smooth and comfortable way. And so, yeah, everyone was ready for a stinker. And the fact that they are intentionally bad singer-songwriters lends itself to criticism, because sometimes you think, oh, maybe they don't know how bad they are.
Mm. So why should a stinker go into the cinema time capsule?
Well, it's a very funny movie. It's also just kind of, you know, it's a fascinating film because Ishtar, so many people never saw Ishtar because it has such a bad, and I was one of them. I didn't see Ishtar until like 2 or 3 years ago.
Mm.
Even though I liked Elaine May, she had a comedy called A New Leaf, which she and Walter Matthau were in, which is very funny. But I was like, oh, this chart is awful. And then I hadn't seen it. And then I watched it. I was like, this is really, really funny. So I thought that a movie that has a reputation of being a terrible film that is actually very funny and is by kind of like three iconic filmmakers, I thought should be in the cinema time capsule.
Mm-hmm. Can I admit something?
Yeah.
I love this film.
Yeah.
And I always have loved this film. Mm. And I saw it in 1987. And
really?
I didn't even know about how bad it was until I watched an episode, how bad critics took it, until I watched an episode of Growing Pains. And there's a scene where, what's the mom's name again?
Is it Carol?
No.
No, that's the sister.
Oh, right.
Simon's going to find that out for me, right, Simon? He's now on it. Anyway, Maggie. Her name's Maggie.
Yes.
And she's like a news correspondent, and she's out doing a news show. Like, she's trying to interview someone, and then the guys in the cab, the van, are waiting, and it's like, now back to Ishtar. And then they roll their eyes, and they get all upset, because it became like in the lexicon how bad it was. Mm. And I remember as a kid thinking, I had fun with it. Because again, one of my wheelhouses, espionage. Mm. It's essentially Spies Like Us.
Yeah.
There's a Far Side comic of Hell, and it's at the video store in Hell. It's just copies of Ishtar.
I know that one.
And then Gary Larson apologized later because he saw the movie. He's like, this is actually fun.
Yeah. He saw it years later, like a lot of us.
Yeah.
So that
is interesting that like the writer and director, and it was so prevalent that this is a terrible movie that it never even you didn't engage with it, just like the majority of the population probably, where it's just it's known as a punchline of a joke that none of us have actually seen to offer that criticism.
I have to say, I like Roger Ebert's writing. Like, mm-hmm. he's really spot on a lot of his reviews, and he and Siskel gave this really impassioned panel. They did an episode where they just destroy it, and I said, okay, it must stink.
Yeah.
Well, because we would watch Siskel and Ebert.
Sure.
And I would become
angry. To
save
us the time, yeah.
I would become angry watching it, because every movie I liked or wanted to see, they would crap on. And so I kind of had a love-hate relationship, because you couldn't go anywhere else for reviews.
Not really.
I didn't read a newspaper,
mm-hmm.
except the comics. Simon, did you see this film ever?
No, I've never seen it. I actually had no idea what it was about. I never got the jokes that were like, oh, Ishtar's a bad movie, because I was like, well, I don't know. I've never seen it. So,
what about at Jumbo Video? Like, no one ever would come in. It would gather dust?
I don't,
you never rented it out, I guess.
I don't know if we had a copy.
See?
No, I don't remember.
And
don't
Joel, you haven't seen anything from the 80s. Did you see this?
Back then, no.
No.
I'm a smuck.
So, okay. So, you're a first-time watcher.
Yep.
Tell us, what are you thinking? Be honest.
I could see the parts that I enjoyed were the over the top, the ridiculous songs. That it was so awkward, and they were oblivious, and they were trying so hard that couldn't help but be very funny to me. That I don't know why. It reminded me of more recent, like Napoleon Dynamite, where it's not a normal movie if you're going into that looking for setup, punchline, and and background laughter.
It's super dry.
Yeah, and you have. I think you have to be in the mood for that if you're looking for lots of in your face jokes. It's way more subtle. Every song is awesome. God. They were so good.
Paul Williams writes the songs.
Yeah.
I was going to bring my guitar today. I had it ready to go because I wanted to surprise you with Dangerous Business. Because I think that's one of the all-time greatest songs.
And some of those, and even that, the smuck, that like, it was almost like what you said about the doctor scene. It's similar. It's simple. It's so, like, it's almost like a throwaway, but if you play it up enough, it becomes funny because you just keep going into it.
It's really funny because Warren Beatty's playing against type. Like, he doesn't play losers in his movies.
Yeah.
And so he's a total loser in this film. And so it's very, the whole movie's kind of meta commentary on Warren Beatty because, it's like you expect this kind of, and he was dating the female lead, Isabella Gianni, at this time. Mm. So, he had this reputation of this kind of debonair stud who's playing a guy who can't get women, who thinks that Dangerous Business is a good insightful song, and who cannot pronounce schmuck. And
smuck.
So
he's pronouncing it.
No, well, he's saying smuck.
Yeah. And like I said it, smuck. There was quite a bit of humor in it that I did enjoy. So, Jeff, what did you...
I'm leaving some love in my will. The song, that I think that was...
it's so stupid.
It's like... I think that was a Dustin Hoffman's song.
Right.
Anytime they were singing together, I just thought it was magic. And then there was the scene where they can't get any performance anywhere because they mm-hmm. suck. And not as bad as the Stains, mind you. But
ouch.
Or Wild Stallions.
Yeah. Well, they're close.
That would be an interesting build to put actually, them both on there.
Actually, this is maybe it's not buddy films. Maybe it's really bad bands that we're talking
yeah.
about. But I love the scene where Warren Beatty has to go and he has to perform on his own.
Oh, that's awesome.
And then what's their name again? What's their last names, the duet's name?
So it's Chuck Connors and Lyle.
Anyway.
Something.
We'll figure it out. But like he's playing on his own. It's kind of, he's not in his wheelhouse. And then all of a sudden Dustin Hoffman comes in with Amore and then everyone gets excited.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what? Like how do they know this band? But I love the lead up when Warren Beatty's sitting there and people just start yelling out songs for them and then one guy goes YMCA. Like it's just one dude, one guy on a piano.
I got the names wrong. It's not Chuck Connors, it's Chuck Clark and Lyle Rogers.
Rogers and Clark. Yeah. So I don't know, I just any of the times where they played the film or the band, the duet, I just thought was magic. It was comedic gold.
There's only one scene that I don't think works all that great is when Dustin Hoffman is doing the fake translation in the desert.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that kind of doesn't work for me. And actually, I like Dustin Hoffman a lot. I think it would have been nice if they had cast someone, because Warren Beatty's so against type in that film. It would have been really funny if, Dustin Hoffman didn't really play losers, so it would have been funny if they had cast someone in the straight man role in the kind of like more like the winner role as someone who usually was a loser.
Mm.
So they've been both playing against
right.
type.
Yeah, I found the some of the sexual innuendo or just assault problematic, and I struggle with that. Where that scene in the airport when the female lead comes up and then like she just flashes.
Yeah,
her
like why do they keep going like, back to that gag?
It's in all the movies, though. It's in Spies Like Us, too. It's Bill and Ted is all about, Bill's mom. Like, Bill's dad, like, had sex with with a woman 3 years older than Bill in Bill's bedroom.
Yeah. Well, we'll get to that. Yeah. We'll get to that, because that's a creepy scene, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the one thing I'm like, I forgot about that scene, and I just was
and
like...
grabbing her.
Well,
at
that
points,
was... Okay, like, so she flashed Dustin Hoffman, yeah. like... Can you just say I'm a woman?
Yeah.
And then the other thing is like, yeah, so then Warren Beatty meets her and then he falls to the floor and then grabs on to her breast to confirm that she's a woman. I'm just like, well, that probably is a dumb gag.
Yeah.
Anyway, I thought it was a fun movie. I found that I started to trail off after the singing components and then it went into the espionage because I didn't think that was done as well as Spies Like Us,
right?
Yeah, that wasn't Elaine May's wheelhouse. There's stories of on set where she didn't really know how to shoot a battle scene.
Sure.
And you couldn't basically tell the director, well, okay, I'll do it, and then you'd have to kind of fire the director.
Mm.
So the battle scenes are, I thought, were a little awkward, and but.
They were a bit funny too, where they're thinking they're being rescued, but really they're under attack.
That was pretty funny,
kind of humorous as well. Yeah. They're oblivious to their lack of musical talent, and then at all those spots, they're oblivious to what's really going on. They just kept thinking things are working out,
and they're so oblivious that they have a blind camel. Who also is by definition oblivious.
I thought that was a good gag.
That was a good gag too. Yeah.
Myself. And I think that's why I like some of these buddy movies, because they go to dumb gags and they just work the gag until you're like, okay, I'm going to laugh now because you're pushing it so much.
Charles Grodin's great, we should say, too.
Mm-hmm. He's always like really deadpan and great.
He's awesome in everything.
So just to note, two heavyweights, Martin Scorsese and Quentin Tarantino, are on record saying they love this film.
Ishtar got 2 votes in the Sight and Sound poll in 2022 for the best movie of all time. So
I wonder if it was those two.
Critics and filmmakers are giving like their top 10 movies of all time. Wow. All time. And Ishtar got 2 votes, which is something.
Yep, that is something. If something else.
If you admit that you can play the accordion, no one will hire you in a rock and roll band, according to Ishtar.
Rodgers and Clark.
Anyway, I think people should pick up the soundtrack regardless if they are going to watch the film. So thank you, Professor. And we're moving on to our next film.
Paging Dr. Marco. Dr. Marco to the podcast. Dr. Marco to the podcast. Stat. Now's the time on the Cinema Time Capsule podcast where we ask Dr. Marco.
Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Marco from California, medical consultant for Cinema Time Capsule. I'm here to answer all your most important medically related cinema questions. Today, we're asking whether or not it improves overall health to have a buddy, the psychology of a buddy. This is obvious. Just look at this podcast. By himself, Jeff, nothing. Joel, even worse. Nothing at all. Inside, nothing. What do they think of themselves? Alone? Nothing. Together, they are amazing, as evidenced by this podcast. Most people like to have a buddy or multiple buddies. You know, there's an epidemic of loneliness. And the way to combat loneliness is to get yourself a buddy. Or maybe listen to this podcast. I don't know. In any case, you will be healthier with a buddy, just like Jeff and Joel. And you will be something, just like Jeff and Joel. Yeah. Anyway, go out and get yourself a buddy. And I promise your health will get better. Everything will feel better. And you'll just be a much better person on the inside and on the outside. Without a buddy, you are nothing. Alrighty, everyone. So that's it for this this episode. Once again, remember to trust my advice as much as you would trust this podcast's advice in the medical context. Okay, have a good day. Bye.
This is Child of the 80s, and we had so much fun talking to Professor Springer that we decided to make it a two-parter. So stay tuned for our next episode of Cinema Time Capsule.
Thanks for joining us today. You can find us online at Facebook, Instagram. Email us at cinematimecapsule@gmail.com. Share the podcast with your friends. Find our polls. We'll look forward to sharing more with you.
And we'll see you at the movies.
This has been the Cinema Time Capsule podcast. For more information about Cinema Time Capsule, please email us at cinematimecapsule@gmail.com. This podcast was produced by Simon Wielden. The theme song was performed by Bruce Turney and Simon Wielden. Thanks for listening.